universities, Jewish schools, summer camps and publications, departments of Judaic studies at universities, and Hebrew classes in Polish schools. In Łódź, the past lives in the present in a different way. For example, in two bronze benches on its main street with sculptured figures of the city's most famous sons, Artur Rubinstein and Julian Tuwim. And in a nearby pub, the rock group Rambo Jet plays songs dedicated to Tuwim's poetry.
Shoin. Gnug is Gnug.
Significant Others was presented by Eva Hoffman. The readers were Henry Goodman, Joanna Brooks, Ben Crow and David Mazawa. Yiddish translations were courtesy of Dr. Helen Beer, and the programme was produced by Mark Berman. 7:30 now, time on Radio 3 to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Thank you, Ian. It's the 14th of July today, Bastille Day, and the French have arrived in the Royal Albert Hall for a romp through four centuries of French ballet music, from the 17th and Lully to Stravinsky in the 20th. The group on stage now tuning up are Les Siècles, a French orchestra founded 10 years ago, who take period performance to a whole new level. Every single piece they're playing tonight, by Lully, Rameau, Delibes, Massenet and Stravinsky, is on instruments authentic to the time. And we're going to hear the UK premiere of the original version of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, as heard 100 years ago in Paris. The band's founder and conductor is François-Xavier Roth.
The whole program is a funny one because the link for sure is the dance, and beyond the only ballet theme is for sure how the composers through the ages used the rhythmical aspect in music to make a new music come. It reflects also the work that we did with this band, this special orchestra, Les Siècles, because since the beginning of the orchestra, 10 years ago already, we loved to perform lots of Jean-Philippe Rameau music. And since 4 years, it was a very, very big project for me and Les Siècles to reconstitute this orchestra from the Ballet Russe.
So the Stravinsky is coming up after the interval, and during that we'll hear more about the history of French dance and ballet. Now, in the very first performance we're going to hear by Lully, François-Xavier Roth is taking authentic performance to its absolute limits, and he's conducting authentically as though he were Lully, who used to use a staff to bang on the podium in time to keep his musicians in order. So here comes François-Xavier Roth now. He's going to take up, and I think you'll hear it very clearly, his staff and start banging it on his podium from the overture and dances from Lully's Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, his collaboration with Molière in 1670.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lacey Eckler, the French period instrument orchestra, beginning their prom with Lully, Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, and moving now 65 years into the future for Rameau's Les Indes Galantes, beginning with the entry of the Four Nations. François Xavier Roth bringing the group to their feet. I think particular applause, really, for the conductor himself, who was banging a staff like Lully, and also the wonderful Turkish percussion, which will make a reappearance. The percussion instrument is about 9 feet tall. It's Turkish bells, although it's actually called a Chinese pavilion, and they've borrowed this particular one from the French National Orchestra, who had it made specially for a Berlioz performance. François Xavier wrote, just fanning himself over this slightly, it gets very hot here in the Albert Hall, which means these period instruments need to retune. They are going to take all of these instruments off after the Rameau. The harpsichord will disappear, so all the theorbos and all of these Baroque violins and period woodwinds. And they're going to bring on a whole new set of instruments for the second part of tonight's concert, music by Massenet and Delibes. All the sections of the orchestra needing to tune, including the woodwind. There are about 14 of them all standing up, ready to perform the Rameau.
Thank you.
period instruments of the French group Les Siècles, sounding really tremendous here in the Royal Albert Hall in this live prom conducted by their founder, started him up 10 years ago, François Xavier Rote, who brought back his Lully staff to conduct during that Rameau, seven dancers from Les Indes Galantes. I don't know if the staff was still technically authentic in Rameau's time, still being used, but he manages to have done this without incident. He hasn't caused himself a gangrenous wound like Lully did, which was the death of him. François Xavier Rote is bringing all of the players to their feet. Pretty big period orchestra, 14 woodwind and brass, including those trumpets coming in for that final bit, and some really amazing percussion. We've tweeted a couple of pictures of the percussion instruments. You can follow us at BBC Radio 3, and of course you can listen to every single prom live. Well, the players are now leaving the stage with all of their instruments. They're not going to be bringing any of these back. As we travel from the 17th and 18th centuries, 135 years on, into the 19th century, and we're also leaving the influence of the Palace of Versailles and moving towards the Paris Opera. They have brought a great number of instruments with them, as François Xavier Rote told me earlier.
We did bring here in London three different sets of instruments. So the first one is the French Baroque instruments for Lully and Rameau. The second one is the French Romantic instruments. And the third one is this unique Parisian instruments from the beginning of the 20th century. And we perform with this last instruments, Le Sacre du Printemps.
Well, my name is Jérôme and I'm playing violin.
And you're holding two instruments?
Yes, I've got two instruments. I've got one violin, which is an original violin from the late 70th century German. And the other one is a copy of an instrument, an Italian instrument of the end of
19th century.
I've got two bows, one romantic and one barocco.
And are you using the same instrument for the Delibes and Massenet as you're using for the Rite of Spring?
Well, for the string, yes. We are just changing from barocco to the Delibes. But for the woodwind and brass, it's different. They are using three different instruments.
The violinist Jérôme Mathieu, one of the players from Les Siècles, whom I spoke to earlier on, and we heard François Xavier Rote as well. And of course, we'll get to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and a sort of recreation of what was very first heard 100 years ago in the Paris performance after the interval. Now, we heard in all of that French Baroque music a great deal of exoticism from the Canary Islands to Turkey and Les Sauvages and four different nations represented in the Rameau. I asked François Xavier Rote about this and how it continues through the centuries.
It did always exist. And for me, it's very interesting in the sense of when you think of Jean-Baptiste Lully, 1670, when he composed with Molière the Bourgeois Gentilhomme, the music was one of the media where you can make people travel. Because it's in real time, and the music sounds and the music itself gives a much stronger suggestion of what could be in America, in India, than only a painting, for example. And for me, it's very symptomatic and interesting to observe that all these composers through the ages, before internet time, before TV, the music was the first link for the artists to make people travel. And we can really have a feeling of that in both Les Indes Galantes and Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme.
And what sort of themes and ideas are around then later on in the repertoire from Delibes?
So with the French Romantic area and these two composers, Massenet and Delibes, it's another story and it's another link to the exotism. It is more, for Massenet in Le Cid, for sure, focused on the Spain. And the Spain with the French is a very funny story. We have in mind Le Bolero de Ravel, España by Chabrier, Iberia by Debussy. The Spain has always been, strangely, because it's quite close to France, a kind of fantasy for the composers. Because all the colors, all the landscapes, all the smell things that you could find there or you could imagine to find there, and the rhythm of the music was absolutely an example for all these composers. So here is more a closer exotism, if I may say, but very important to the French. The Spain is extremely important. And with the Lib, it is something to do really more with specifically the ballet. De Lib really is the inventor of the Romantic ballet. Before Coppelia, we don't have examples of works that in music with dance are so important or so highly composed.
Well, we're going to hear more about the history of French dance music in the interval from an event that happened earlier on across the road from the Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music with Petroc Trelawney, joined by the dance historian Jane Pritchard and Richard Langham Smith. So do stay tuned for that to find out more and put the music that we're hearing in context. If you've just tuned in to BBC Radio 3, we're live at the Albert Hall for the proms. And if you missed the sensational Rameau and Lully that we just heard, this prom is being repeated on Wednesday afternoon on Radio 3. And you can, of course, listen on demand online for another 7 days after this broadcast. And you'll also be able to watch it on television next Sunday. So a great deal more players now on stage. As we move to the 19th century, François Xavier Rote coming on stage to conduct Les Siècles, in four pieces from Delibes' Coppelia, the entr'acte and waltz, and then the prelude and mazurka.
Thank you.
the mazurka, and before it, the waltz from Coppelia by Leo Delibes. Music for the French Ballet written around 1870. And we're moving 15 years into the future now, to 1885, for a selection of Spanish dances from Massenet's ballet Le Cid, which also actually harks back to the 17th century. It's based on a drama by the French playwright and poet Pierre Corneille called Le Cid, based on an old Spanish story, as we heard François Xavier wrote talking earlier on about the French obsession with Spain and how, for a long time, that was their version of exoticism. So here are five dances from Le Cid.
Thank you. making an absolutely huge sound in the Royal Albert Hall. Les Siècles, directed by François-Xavier Roth. Playing on period instruments, the music of Massenet, the ballet music from his opera Le Cid. François-Xavier Roth pointing particularly to the Ophicleide player there. Lots of extraordinary instruments they've brought with them, many of which are going to disappear for the second half of this prom as they take us to 1913 and Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. But there we heard dances that would have absolutely delighted the Paris audience at the opera in 1885. Woodwind and brass coming to their feet. And the strings of this fantastic period instrument band that cover pretty much all repertoire. Dido was speaking earlier to one of the violinists, who's an English player, Rachel Roundtree. She was saying how lovely it is to find an orchestra where she can play her Baroque violin and her modern one as well under the same conductor. Although she said it does take a little bit of readjustment of your mindset moving all the way from Lully to Stravinsky in just one concert as they're doing tonight. Well, we're now going to find out a little bit more about the way that the ballet and the opera crossed over in Paris and how dance evolved in Paris and France over the four centuries that tonight's music is spanning. A conversation which happened earlier on this afternoon across the road from the Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music with our very own Petrop Trelawney.
Tonight we are considering four centuries of French ballet music and the composers who wrote for Paris's dancers. To guide us through what is a fascinating story, I'm joined by Jane Pritchard, who is curator of dance at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and Richard Langham-Smith, research professor here at the Royal College of Music, a man whose interests stretch from the French Baroque to the music of Debussy. Very useful for this evening. Please welcome my guests. Well, given that the repertoire in tonight's concert, Lully and Rameau, then Delibes and Massenet, and finally Stravinsky, is spread into three sections of time, it makes some sense for us to divide our conversation into three parts as well. Let's start with the Baroque. Jane, the first surviving score of a French ballet comes from 1581, so even that early, Paris was ballet capital of the world.
I think one can say that the interest in dance as a real focus had shifted by that time from Italy to France. And yes, from then on, I think one has always actually got to consider what is happening, particularly in Paris, but in France generally.
Richard, was there ever a monarch who loved his ballet as much as Louis XIV did?
Yes, probably Louis XIII. I think the whole thing of the king dancing the grand ballet at the end of the year, maybe one a year, became a sort of institution. Because ballet, all you had to know if you wanted to get on in court was how to dance.
Why? Why was it so important?
Well, I think it's something to do with the idea that if you learn the discipline of dancing, you somehow learn control and order and rhythm and all those things the French loved so much. Whereas in Italy, singing seems to have been more important.
What did the dancers look like? What did the dancers wear in Lully's time?
Well, the dancers are wearing costumes that look very, very heavy. I mean, we think of dancers loving to wear next to nothing because then they can move freely. But basically, it's the same as court costume, elaborated, because we're looking at costumes that essentially are masks. Often, the dancers did actually have masks on as well, so and elaborate headdresses, which, of course, modern dancers loathe. But they were, you know, as I say, really parading, moving, rather than sort of leaping around or anything like that. Of course, shoes would have had heels. Coats would be heavy. At this time, it was all men. It wasn't women being part of it. Very few women seem to have sort of crept in, but it was really a very masculine art form at this point.
It's very interesting you mention about trying to recapture performances, because although we can never quite know, we spend an awful lot of time doing it. And one of the things about Lully, which is the most important thing that happened for string playing, was that a German, Georg Muffat, went and listened to Lully's band playing as they did, with their bows actually going the same way, and notated absolutely everything they did, how they used bowings in minuets, short bows and slightly shorter ones, huge detail. If we didn't know that, the past 50 years of trying to create a concert like tonight's just wouldn't exist.
Lully was absolutely in charge of music at court at this point, wasn't he? I mean, he had the say on any other composers being used.
Absolutely. And, I mean, we all, even tonight, have an authentic conductor who is beating on the ground with a stick, not quite as hard as Lully did when he rammed it on his foot and caught gangrene. But the whole idea of the conductor is somewhere up for grabs tonight.
Lully had this great relationship with Molière that led to the music that we're hearing this evening. And this was almost the beginning, was it, of this sort of French idea of any stage art form had to have a bit of ballet in it.
Well, it's certainly the sort of the beginning whereby sort of dance gets integrated into the whole area of theatre. And so we think perhaps of sort of Bourgeois Gentilhomme as a play now, but when it was being performed, it was very deliberately worked so that you had opportunities for dance, not only that came directly out of the narrative, such as learning to dance, but also when the tailors come on to dress the gentleman, Monsieur Jourdain, they are actually dancing a minuet. So you integrated dance into the whole thing as to make it much more complete. And throughout sort of the French history, dance is often integrated into other areas of performance rather than kept in isolation.
And we'll talk about that with relation to the 19th century in a moment. Let's skip forward 65 years to 1735. Rameau's Les Ânes Galantes, first seen in 1735. France, too, perhaps had it become a bit less insular? Was there more of an interest in what was happening in Italy at this point?
I think there's always a sort of sense of what's going on, but I think France was very much also concerned with its own status, and I think that comes through very strongly in Les Ânes Galantes.
Well, certainly in music, the interest in Italy caused a great rumpus in France because there were the conservatives who wanted the music to stay like the air de cour and like Lully's music and not be invaded by these wild Italian violinists who played much too fast. And they also played with the regularity of a well-adjusted clock, where the French loved to make things swing a bit in this style called inégale, which is a bit like do-do-do-do-do, do-do-do. It's a bit more like jazz playing, which is not notated equally, but which just swings a little bit. And Rameau was one of those who really did things between the two. He made a music which had completely retained many of the French aspects, particularly of the dance rhythms behind it. But his violins move in a much, much more virtuosic way. His harmonies, he was a complete harmonic genius in a way and theorized it all. And his music is much more advanced. And he's beginning also to anticipate the modern orchestra, not using the oboes and the flutes just as instruments which play along with the violins, but which really have something idiomatic. You'll hear his music is very characterful, much more than Lully.
I think that virtuosity is something as well that's coming through in the dance as well. The dancers are performing far more in the way of sort of turns, so pirouettes, particularly still beaten steps, so cabrioles, entrechats, being very, very important. So the virtuosity of the dancers, certainly the leading dancers, is something that stands out. And so that's complemented by the music.
And there are clear narrative stories now.
Well, we're very much moving into, I mean, with something like sort of Angelante, more or less, in a way, it has obviously symbolic elements because it's about sort of, you know, celebrating the noble savage in a way.
Yes, Les Ânes Galantes is very interesting and in some ways quite amusing because the idea really is that everybody who lived in these so-called Indies, and we have four sort of separate scenes, one, the last one is called Les Sauvages, the savages. Well, all the savages have to do if they want to be civilized is to learn how to do the minuet. And that sort of idea of the four scenes, the ballet, the whole thing is, they love this genre, and this is a opera ballet rather than the Lully piece, which is a comedy ballet. Comedy doesn't mean it's funny, it means it's a play, because it comes from the word comédien. And but the opera ballet was something, and it was the last one ever written. There was a whole string of opera ballets on themes like the Muses or the Seasons, where you could actually have related entrees or ballets on similar themes. There was no more nymphs and cupids and stuff. It tended to be getting away from that kind of thing.
Let's move to the 19th century, the late 19th century, Coppelia in 1870, Le Cid by Massenet in 1885. And had ballet now in Paris become something that we could associate much more closely with ballet today, the idea of companies, theatres, schools, etc.?
I think that it was a situation where we would recognise it as a traditional ballet company. So we might have some problems in recognising sort of the sort of 18th century style of work. But 19th century is really, I think, the foundation of what we see today. So, yes, the hierarchy within the companies, the training in the ballet schools, and everything to do with it was certainly recognisable.
Delibes' journey, Richard, towards the ballet was rather an interesting one.
He wasn't very good at college, basically. His musical training was not outstanding, but he'd had sung in the cathedral scene of Meyerbeer's Le Prophet, because he went to the Madeleine Maîtrise, the church school at the Madeleine in Paris, and so he had a very early exposure to the real stage life on the Paris opera stage. And he then teamed up, well, his sort of protégé was Adolphe Adam, who is the composer mainly known for Giselle, but who actually really taught him the craft, because he was a composer of 53 operas and 10 mostly forgotten ballets except for Giselle. And he got Delibes a job as a repetiteur in a minor opera comique place, really light opera. And this word we've been coming on, comique, is a very important one, because the ballet comique de la Reine isn't funny. And there was the story of an Englishman who went to the opera comique who didn't speak a word of French but didn't want to let anybody know. And so every now and again he guffawed. And there weren't actually any jokes. It was a very serious opera comique. I mean, Bizet's Carmen is not a bundle of laughs, really. So that word comique has to be stressed, I think.
You must mention Delibes' comic operas that he did write.
Again, stories of these things became more and more ridiculous. One was about the cooking of an omelette with all kinds of ashes in it and tobacco and various other things, which were served to some guests who wolfed it up and said it was lovely.
At this point, opera wanted in Paris ballet in it, didn't it? It was inconceivable that you could do an opera in Paris without having a dance section to it.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the things that was very sort of characteristic of the French opera, was that you really had to incorporate a dance scene. And a dance scene means, you know, something like 20 minutes of dance. So what we would think of as a one-act ballet, and they were really integral to it. And if you were a composer whose work had gone on elsewhere, so for example, Verdi, he would rewrite his operas for Paris and incorporate the ballet scenes. So it was something that was terribly important. And if you didn't have your opera with a ballet, you would have to add a ballet at the end of the evening.
And no one was exempt. Tannhäuser had a ballet put in.
Well, when it went on, it didn't, and that caused a great deal of problem. So there are rare occasions. But likewise, you didn't go to an evening of ballet, as people expect to do now. You wouldn't just go and see even Coppelia. You would always have another work with it, which would be an opera or a scene from an opera. The idea of a full evening of dance was just horrible.
But the other way around, it meant there was plenty of work for dancers in Paris.
There was an enormous amount of work for dancers in Paris, because not only were they performing at the opera, but there were a lot of popular theatres that incorporated ballet. So within the popular fairy, the sort of fairy tale pantomime productions that were going on, in the music halls there were ballets as well. So actually there were probably more dancers being employed in Paris at that point than there have been sort of before or since.
And was there a crossover between what the dancers were doing, or was there a sort of snobbery that, you know, a certain level was at the opera and then another level was doing the more popular stuff?
I think there is a certain snobbery. So, yes, to be at the Paris Opera was the ultimate. But having said that, there are choreographers who briefly work at the opera and probably were earning good money elsewhere, and why shouldn't they go off and earn good money? Some of the dancers would choose to move from the Paris Opera to the Opera Comique to the music hall. So there was, I think, much more sort of flow. And, of course, there were dancers from abroad who were incorporated into the Paris Opera. They weren't exclusively dancers that they had trained.
We're hearing an authentic instrument performance of all of the works in this concert this evening. So you might, Richard, want to say a bit about how that relates to Coppelia. Horns, I know, are particularly interesting.
Well, the orchestra for Coppelia had completely changed from Rameau. I think three things probably had happened. One was the growth of the wind section and brass section, and the horns in particular, which were not as modern as the horns in the Rite of Spring, where you have valves, and they had to be played either by altering the crooks so that a horn player would come in with several crooks on his arm and change the plumbing, as it were, on the instrument, but also put his fist up the bell, which is how you actually got the two scales enabling you to play chromatic music. And when you do that, you get a very different tone on the stop notes. So that is one thing. There's also the introduction of the instrument, the ophicleide, which is in the Coppelia score and will be heard this evening. And
which is what?
An ophicleide is a large instrument, I think blown like a horn. It's a mouthpiece, not a reed. And also the other instruments, which are very important, are the cornet à piston, which is the little trumpets that were still in use at the time up to the 1880s, really, which make a much thinner sound than the modern trumpet. So the wind sound, the sound of the wind section, and this is true for the Rite of Spring as well, is very, very different from how it was going to be today.
Well, let's talk about the Rite of Spring and those famous events of over a century ago. We're promised this evening a recreation of the score as heard at its 1913 premiere, presumably without the shouting and other noises off from the audience, although who knows. This is going to be rather exciting, isn't it?
It's going to be very exciting. I mean, the other thing is, of course, that Stravinsky makes we can talk about the instruments, but really it's the people who play them and how you play them, right from Lully all the way through. Because you can now take five or six different performances of music on authentic instruments, and they all sound quite different. But the Rite of Spring, certainly, I've never heard it before on these instruments, which have crept forward. You can hear Schumann, you can hear, I think, some Wagner, so-called authentic instruments. And I still think the most important thing is the different sound of the wind. But when you get to Stravinsky, he is making people play higher in the register than they have before. He's making them use harmonics on the violins, playing glissando on harmonics, and all kinds of techniques which really were asking beyond the bounds of what the players could do. Isn't that the same thing with the choreography, in a sense, that Nijinsky asked people to do things sort of out of their comfort zone?
Oh, absolutely. The dancers were absolutely horrified at having to do things that were totally away from their training, indeed inverted their training in many senses. So I think that, yes, it is that sense of really sort of breaking away. I think we must remember that, I mean, we are talking about Paris, and one of the things that's really, I think, fascinating about tonight's concert is the opportunity to hear the music. So we've actually got this sense of evolution. So often we're getting accounts that say, of course, this is a big change from sort of Tchaikovsky and The Sleeping Beauty. Well, for the Parisian audiences, it was still ballets like Coppelia that they were used to. And so it's that is being sort of turned on its head.
Because
so
Tchaikovsky ballets weren't done in Paris?
They weren't being performed in Paris at that point. So it's before we tend to sort of have written history on a universal basis rather than a local basis, so that you don't get a real sense of evolution. It's something that's really rather bizarre. But having said that, I think what was happening with the Rite of Spring was that The ideas for the production certainly came from both the designer Rurik and Stravinsky, and Nijinsky, who choreographed it, comes in very much at the last moment. It's only the year before that he starts to choreograph in terms of main works for the Ballet Russe, and so he is something of a novelty. But he was somebody who was prepared to go completely outside the dancer's comfort zone in everything he did.
Had Paris, by the start of the 20th century, lost a bit of its gloss as world ballet capital? Had some of that gone to St. Petersburg?
Well, I think undoubtedly that there was a real interest in what was happening in St. Petersburg in particular. I think that was... reports of dance in the Imperial Ballet were filtering out, so there was an awareness that there was something happening. Having said that, there were still major productions going on in Paris. I think they had become fairly routine, rather less innovative than they had been. So it wasn't a sense that they were moving forward, it was a sense that they were marking time.
So does France have fair claim on the Rite of Spring as being a French ballet, or is it really a Russian ballet?
Oh, it's a Russian ballet, definitely a Russian ballet.
But it just happens to
have landed
in Paris.
Premiered in France. But I think it's also quite interesting that, of course, Parisian audiences do like novelties, and I think that's still true today.
And no shortage, Richard, of Russianness in the music.
The Rite of Spring, I think we're only really now beginning to understand it, in the sense that it is absolutely packed full of Russian wedding songs from various collections, because when it was written, 1909 was the period when we had our equivalent in England, but there was a huge force in many countries to revive folk music, to some extent through the evolution of the phonograph, and to some extent by absolutely avid collectors going around and finding tunes. And the tunes in the Rite of Spring, the melodies that he uses, very simple very often in shape, are actually taken from a book with something like 1,700 Lithuanian wedding songs, which have been found by a recent biographer of Stravinsky, unearthing this whole thing that you were mentioning, Rurik, and the primitive ballet. The idea was somehow that refined art had lost its honesty and purity, and that it had to be revived by that.
Yes, I think one must remember that just as Stravinsky is mining the folk tunes and everything, so Rurik was somebody who was absolutely fascinated by Russian history. It's very much the equivalent in a way of our arts and crafts, almost sort of recreating a Russian folk art that was happening at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And he's building on that. He's also fascinated by archaeology, so there are those elements that go in. So he's drawing on the past. And I think this is one of the things that's very exciting with The Rite of Spring, because here is the work, it's absolutely typical of what modernism is about, that really is based on the past but is reinterpreted and represented for audiences, for contemporary audiences, and in a way that excites them and to a certain extent also shocks them.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you both very much indeed for being with us this evening. Jane Pritchard and Richard Langham Smith.
And that was Petra Trelawney presenting our 20 Minutes feature. Tomorrow's is hosted by Rana Mitter. It's a Proms literary event talking about Mahler's letters. So welcome back live to the Royal Albert Hall for this Sunday night prom. On Bastille Day, the French have invaded the Royal Albert Hall, and there are many more of them than there were before. The stage is really swollen to full capacity. Over 100 players of Les Siècles, directed by François-Xavier Roth, who formed them 10 years ago. And of course, as we know, we're about to hear The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, which 100 years ago caused such a storm in Paris. One of the most famous things about this is the opening, a bassoon solo, incredibly fragile and incredibly difficult to play. At least it was then. Nowadays, bassoonists have really got it under their fingers, but the instrument we're going to hear it played on now makes it a whole lot harder. I asked François-Xavier Roth about this particular bassoon we're going to hear.
French bassoon, le basson français. Now, sadly, the French bassoon almost disappeared. You know, I'm so glad that we bring this orchestra today, because the 20th century, in a way, was amazing. I'm not a nostalgic person. I love our time. But what I miss is the particularity of every orchestra. For example, in Paris, at the time of Le Sacre du Printemps, you could find 10, 15 different flute makers. In Paris, today, in the whole world, all the flutists of the world play on 5 different flute makers. It says a lot. The globalization of the instruments, and today, to go back to your question, all the bassoon of the world are German system, which is very fine. It's another instrument, but it's not at all the instrument that Stravinsky had in his ears. He thought of Le Basson Français with this, and all this beginning, not only the bassoon, or the first part of Le Sac, is really a tribute to the woodwinds in their brilliancy, in their characterization. It's because Stravinsky did discover the French players with Le Firebird. And it was for him a long process till the Sacre du Printemps with this instrument in his ears.
François Xavier wrote, and what is so wonderful about hearing the Rite of Spring on these instruments as they would have been played in 1913 by the original performers of the Rite of Spring is that Stravinsky's orchestration is so precise, so wonderfully coloured. The bassoon solo, for example, is that much more fragile because it's played on this instrument. In fact, there's a fragility about a great deal of the woodwind. On the other hand, the brass, it's easier, according to a trumpeter I spoke to earlier, to play a lot of this music on the trumpet of the period than it is to make a really loud sound on a modern trumpet. So what you'll hear is a sort of rebalancing of the orchestra if you're used to hearing this piece of music played on contemporary instruments. And it's thanks to the publishers Boosey and Hawkes who've given special permission for this particular edition to be used. There are a few little tweaks and changes which Stravinsky made to the very original performing score, which became the official performing score much later on, which absolutely everybody uses now. So this really is a quite extraordinary occasion here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, to be hearing a recreation of the original version from 1913 of The Rite of Spring. And it's the perfect place to conclude this survey of 4 centuries of French ballet music, beginning with Lully and Rameau, moving through Massenet and Delibes, and finally ending up with the Ballet Russe. Tonight's conductor, founder of the orchestra Les Siècles, which are 10 years old, François Xavier wrote, bringing his players to their feet and taking the applause of the full Royal Albert Hall. This is Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, Le Sacre du Printemps.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, like many of you listening, I'm sure you've heard that piece several times. I have, but I don't think I've ever heard such a nail-biting edge-of-your-seat performance of Stravinsky's groundbreaking 1913 ballet, The Rite of Spring. Live here at the BBC Proms at the Royal Albert Hall, we just heard the first ever performance in the UK of that recreation of the score exactly as it was heard at the revolutionary 1913 premiere of The Rite of Spring, the Sacre du Printemps. Thanks to conductor François Xavier Roth and his period instrument ensemble, Les Siècles. That round of applause was for the principal bassoonist, Michael Roland, who played that exquisite solo right at the beginning on a French bassoon, which is almost never heard today. That's the 20-strong brass section on their feet, five percussionists, and the strings. 100 players exactly on stage, including François Xavier Roth, Les Siècles' leader tonight, François-Marie Drieux. So wonderful to hear this music performed on instruments of the time. The brass in that final sacrificial dance as a girl dances herself to death in a pagan ritual, it was just that more biting and bright and energized. And the woodwind just that much more fragile. Something so spectacular about hearing it. François Xavier Roth prepared our ears as best he could for that. I suppose in a way we were an authentic audience. We'd heard French dance music through the eras, from Lully and Rameau to Massenet and Delibes. But I suppose it just goes to show that nothing can prepare you for the Rite of Spring. The whole of the orchestra, Les Siècles, turning around now to bow to all of those sitting behind them on either side of the organ. This is the fourth performance they've given of this extraordinary programme. It started in Paris, of course, and here they are now in London. They're touring supported by the Institut Français. They want him back. Here he is, François Xavier Roth, making his way back on stage. Shaking the hand of the leader, François-Marie Drieux, bringing each section one by one to their feet. The 2013 prom started on Friday. This is prom number four. Please be wondering, where on earth do we go from here? Well, the first place we go tomorrow is to Cadogan Hall at 1 o'clock in the afternoon for the first of the Proms chamber music concerts with the violinist Wilde Frang, who's also picked three pieces of music for Radio 3 listeners to hear tomorrow. You can hear them in Breakfast, Essential Classics, and In Tune. And then in the evening, we're joining the Arditti Quartet and Bamberg Symphony Orchestra and Jonathan Knott for Lachenmann and Mahler. And now, as the applause continues here in South Kensington at the Royal Albert Hall, I'll hand you on to Ian Skelly in Broadcasting House.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Sarah Moore-Peach had a very lively Royal Albert Hall tonight. Well, there are plenty more opportunities to hear that prom concert if you came in at the very end of it. You can certainly listen again anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days by going to the Radio 3 website and then navigating your way to the Listen Again options on the iPlayer Radio. Or if you prefer, you can hear the entire prom again when we rebroadcast tonight's programme on Wednesday afternoon here on Radio 3. You can hear a BBC prom every afternoon throughout the season. Tomorrow afternoon, for instance, we begin the week with a chance to hear the first prom of the season. Music by Rachmaninoff and Vaughan Williams dominated the evening on Friday. A spectacular performance of Rachmaninoff's variations on a theme by Paganini. It was played by Stephen Huff. And then over 500 voices filled the Albert Hall in a performance of Vaughan Williams' first symphony, the Sea Symphony. The BBC Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Zachary Oramo on Friday, and you can hear it all at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3.
Mozart, Rachmaninoff, and an all-Verdi anniversary programme at the BBC Proms. Two concerts from Sir Antonio Pappano and the Orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia. The ceremonial fizz and pomp of Mozart's Haffner Symphony and the melancholy and high drama of Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2 on Friday night, and a celebration of the bicentenary of Giuseppe Verdi on Saturday. Two BBC Proms concerts with Sir Antonio Pappano starting Friday night at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
I have Mozart for you next tonight, but stay tuned if you can for a session by a member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme in this week's edition of Jazz Lineup later. The jazz saxophonist Trish Klaus, bringing her jazz quintet to the studio for a session that begins at 11:30 tonight. And before it, you can hear what something called Panzori sounds like. It's a form of musical drama from Korea, and Radio 3's microphones were at the K Music 2013 festival last month to record it for the programme. The programme is World Roots, and it begins tonight in just under 20 minutes time at 10 o'clock. But yes, Mozart, as Sarah was mentioning there, tomorrow, live from the Proms Chamber recital series at 1 o'clock, you can hear Wilde Frang playing a violin sonata by Mozart, the one in G, Kirchel 379. Well, here to whet your appetite now is one in F, and it's played by a forte pianist, Jos von Immerseel, and the violinist Midori Zeiler. Thank you. The violinist Midori Zeiler and the fortepianist Jos von Immerseel playing Violin Sonata by Mozart, the one in F major, Köchel 377. And tomorrow on Radio 3 you can hear another close neighbour of that piece, the one in G, Köchel 379. This time a modern piano will take to the stage at Cadogan Hall in London, along with the violin belonging to Wilde Frang. The pianist will be Michael Liefitz. And as well as the Mozart, you can hear them playing the sonata by Ravel and music by Lutosławski, one of his partitas. That's launching this year's Proms Chamber Music Recital series, and it's all live here on Radio 3 tomorrow lunchtime at 1 o'clock. And, by the way, you'll be able to see that performance once it's been given. It'll appear on the Proms website, where you can also see what's so far been filmed or televised of the BBC Proms at the Royal Albert Hall. The first night, for example, and also parts of last night's prom, which played to a full two-capacity audience, the Doctor Who prom, all manner of surprise and guest appearances. bbc.co.uk/proms for video online and much, much more besides. Well, guests tomorrow night at the Proms will be the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra and a string quartet, the Arditi Quartet. String quartet and orchestra combining to give the UK premiere of a new piece by Helmut Lechenmann, Musik Konkret, never before heard at the Proms. And after that, one of Mahler's most popular symphonies, his Fifth Symphony, composed in the very first years of the 20th century with that famous Adagietto by his love letter to his wife Alma. We're live at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow at 7:30. Hope you can join us. Time now on Radio 3, though, for World Roots with Lucy Duran.
Hello, tonight we're at Cadogan Hall in London for a night devoted to Korean traditional music. It's all part of a week-long festival of visiting Korean artists. And tonight, the highlight is Pansori, traditional Korean musical drama performed by the acclaimed singer An Suk-sun. We'll also hear a piece from the so-called Important Intangible Cultural Heritage No. 23, as designated by the Korean government, a virtuoso pansori song accompanied on the kayagum, the Korean 12-string zither. I'll be talking to An Suk-sun later on, but now I'm joined for the evening by the traditional Korean flautist and music researcher, Hyerim Kim. Hyerim, give us an idea of what we're going to be hearing tonight.
Well, Korean music has a very long history, dating back 5,000 years, when shamanistic song and dance were part of the Asian society. And a royal court music developed in the 14th century during the Joseon Dynasty. Actually, at the time, different kinds of music were played depending on what kind of places and people were performing. Along with the court music, there was another kind of music performed among common people.
And is that what we're going to be hearing tonight?
Yes. This music is for folk people, common people. Tonight we'll hear folk music of Korea, more specifically pansori.
And so pansori is a folk music, but it's sometimes described as opera. It's not opera?
It's all done by one singer, even though it's accompanied by one drummer, but it's very simple form of singing. So it can't be said pansori is an opera.
But it is a kind of a musical drama. A story is told.
Pansori tells a lot of interesting stories from old Korea. The epic storytelling, the pansori, has a wide spectrum of tone colors, including harsh sounds and variety of ornaments to express that kind of dynamics of a Korean history.
How unusual is it to hear pansori performed outside Korea?
An Suk-sun, the pansori singer we're going to hear tonight. She's the most acclaimed singer in Korea. It is even hard to see her in Korea.
Really?
Yes.
So we're in for a very, very special treat.
Yes, of course.
So first of all, we're going to be hearing something on an instrument called the komungo.
Yes. The komungo is a zither on which six silk strings are stretched over a soundboard made of wood. And the second, third, and fourth strings are on 16 frets, while the rest of strings are supported by movable bridges. And most significant thing about this instrument is that the strings are struck by a pencil-like stick. This motion gives a very sharp percussive attack to each note.
So here, from Cadogan Hall in London, this is Choi Young-hun on the komungo, the zither, playing a sanjo, or a solo improvisation. Thank you.
Thank you.